It's time to get nerdy, y'all.
A little bit of gaming history for you.
Something relevant in gaming and discuss our opinions on it.
Should we kick it out of here or should we kick start it?
This is the part where you, the listeners, try to stump the hosts.
I'm not a lawyer. I just play one on a podcast.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, it's Tuesday, November 28th, 2023, and you know what that means. It's time to get nerdy, y'all. Welcome to episode number 290 of Two Nerds in a Pod. Mac, we're 10 episodes away from 300 episodes. I am Lam, also known as Mr. Nice Guy, joined by my comrade in gaming commentary, the miggity, 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 miggity Mac, also known as Maction. Mac, how you been? How was Thanksgiving, man?
Thanksgiving was very enjoyable, Mr. Nice Guy. We actually had old friends in the area. Friends that I went to high school with.
Love it.
So we all did Thanksgiving together. A proper Thanksgiving meal.
Sure.
Around a table. Out here on the West Coast. Fantastic. Pumpkin pie. Pecan pie. No sweet potato pie. And my amazing spouse made some lemon creme brulee with candied lemon on top. It was to die for. I feel a little bit bad, though, because we were invited. We brought way too much food. We overdid it. And then, of course, you know, I feel bad because I almost feel like especially the creme brulee desserts. A lot of people went for that.
Sure.
And didn't go for the pumpkin pie.
Okay.
And such. And so I feel kind of like we were upstaging a bit, maybe, but hopefully it was not received that way. Hopefully this is just one of those silly things that your brain tells you and you just have to be, shush up, brain. We did everything okay. It's fine. Anyway, a glorious Thanksgiving.
Speaking of desserts, before I talk about my Thanksgiving, one of the funniest stories that you've ever told me, and I think about this every single time that I eat cobbler, like not peach cobbler, like pie, but like cobbler, like Dutch oven cobbler. Do you know the story I'm thinking of?
I do, but I want to hear you say it.
So I just remember you telling me, and I don't know if it was a friend or if it was a family member, but you went camping. You had all the stuff for this awesome cobbler, right? You had, you know, your butter. You know, you had your filling. I don't know what flavor it was. You had your cake mix. Maybe you had some 7-Up or some ginger ale to pour on top. Like, you had everything. Maybe you even had nuts. And you said to your friend, you know, do you want to make the cobbler? Or they volunteered to make the cobbler. That detail I don't remember. But you had a conversation. You said, you've done this before, right? You know how to make a cobbler, right? And they said, of course I know how to make cobbler. It's not rocket science. And I'm exaggerating, but the conversation went that way. And you went and did something, and they made the cobbler. And you came back, and they had poured everything in the Dutch oven, and they were stirring it up together.
That was a doozy of a dessert.
Did I tell the story right? Did I do it justice?
Oh, you absolutely did it justice, Mr. Nice Guy. That is almost exactly, that's all the important beats. And never again do I let anybody else make my cobbler. Mm-mm.
Yeah, that's not how you make a cobbler. But anyway, my Thanksgiving was really good. We did smoke some meat. Mm. We smoked turkey. We went with turkey breast this year, which is not what we traditionally do. We typically go with a full turkey, but we wanted to try turkey breast. I think that is one of the best parts of the turkey. It was fantastic. And we did ham, and then my wife made a bunch of pies, and it was phenomenal. And I think we all ate too much, and we still have leftovers. After we get done podcasting, I may go upstairs and have a leftover piece of pie, because we had that many pies in the Galooka household. And more importantly, we spent time with family, and it was really good. And Mac, we have so much to be thankful for, including this awesome podcast.
Mm-hmm.
And I say we do what we do best and talk about one of our favorite hobbies and hop right up in that gaming news, my friend. What do you think about that?
Absolutely. Mr. Nice Guy, tell me, what is new in video gaming?
So, so much. And thank you, everyone, for tuning in here live and after the fact to episode 290 of Two Nerds in a Pod, nerdiest video game podcast in the galaxy. Mac, I don't know if you knew this, but Bethesda is responding to negative reviews of Starfield on Steam. This is on IGN.com, written by Wesley Yin Poole. Bethesda has taken the unusual step for a AAA video game maker of responding to negative reviews of Starfield on Steam. As spotted by Project Zomboid developer Andy Hodgetts and flagged in a tweet, representatives of the Microsoft-owned company have been replying to negative reviews on Valve's platform since early November amid Starfield's mixed user review rating of 69%. Here's one of the reviews. I'm going to read part of it, and then I'm going to read part of their response. And then I'd love to get your thoughts on this method from a game developer of responding to reviews. Here's what the user wrote. Boring and overrated. There is a wide universe to explore filled mostly with empty planets. I understand they have to do that to sell you on the idea that this is a whole universe, but that doesn't make the game more fun. You can land on any planet and explore the copy-pasted locations. You'll see the exact same locations from one end of the universe to another and everywhere in between. A hodgepodge of messy slap-together mechanics, bloated skill trees, exploring, crafting, base building, and RPG and FPS, a space opera. Starfield doesn't know what it wants to be. As wide as the ocean and as deep as a puddle, you can explore everywhere, but why would you want to? I think that's a harsh review, having played Starfield, but that's neither here nor there. Here is how they are responding. And the response came from someone named Bethesda _ Kraken, who signed off their post as coming from Bethesda customer support. Here's what they wrote, Mac. Greetings. Thank you for taking the time to leave a review for Starfield. We're sorry that you do not like landing on different planets and are finding many of them empty. Some of Starfield's planets are meant to be empty by design, but that's not boring. Quote, when the astronauts went to the moon, there was nothing there. Hold on. I just scrolled up on accident. This is a funny quote, though. Okay, quote, when the astronauts went to the moon, there was nothing there. They certainly weren't bored. The intention of Starfield's exploration is to evoke a feeling of smallness in players and make you feel overwhelmed. You can continue to explore and find worlds that do have resources you need or hidden outposts to look through. To provide feedback to development for Starfield, please feel free to submit your feedback using this form here. Never stop exploring. Bethesda customer support. Mac, what do you think about responding to reviews, and what do you think about this particular response?
Okay, so I think in theory, the idea of responding to reviews is good. The idea of reviews there to give feedback to a company on what they've produced is, in theory, definitely good. You would hope that if people are not finding something fun or enjoyable, that they could share that with the company, either directly or slightly indirectly in the shape of reviews. Reviews is more for us players to share with us players or prospective players than it is to necessarily share with the company direct. But, you know, it is a sort of get the word out there, right?
Sure.
But it's usually not a thing that we see from the AAAs. It's usually a thing we mostly see from the indie devs responding to reviews.
Right.
I am a bit amused by their, well, you know, they certainly didn't find the moon being empty, you know, boring. It's just like, yeah, but
right.
It's a little bit different.
Exactly.
Right? I don't know. I feel like it's a little bit less than a canned, you know, than a canned response. And I liked that it's not just a canned response that's just like, oh, we're sorry. And we've all seen these canned responses on reviews where it's just like, oh, we're sorry that it did not meet your expectations. Please feel free to reach out to us direct and da da da. I'm glad that it wasn't that, but also I'm not sure if this is necessarily better because it is, while it is different in content, it is the same in substance because it really just says, sorry you're not having a good time, has one extra line, and then it's just like, use our feedback form. So it really isn't right. All that different, even though it has an amusing line that I think misses the point. Mr. Nice Guy, what do you think?
I mean, the idea that someone could write a detailed review and then be told, hey, why don't you come fill out this form to give feedback? I'd be like, nope, I just gave you my feedback. I wrote a review, and I'm not going to do it now privately just because you don't like that your game is not getting the reviews that you want publicly. Like, that's not how I would handle it. The thing that's interesting to me is, I guess I don't have a problem with people responding to reviews. You want to defend your work, right?
Mm-hmm.
But responding to a review that is subjective and telling the person that they are wrong is a waste of everybody's time. If they said something objective like, the game, everything is red. I don't like that the whole game is red. and it hurts my eyes and I don't like that it's red. Sure, respond and be like, what are you talking about? There's a whole gamut of colors here. The game is not all red. That is incorrect, sir or ma'am. But when someone says, I'm bored, the planets are empty, you know, you can't tell them that they are not bored or that they should not be bored, because other people who experienced this in real life were not bored when they flew up in a spaceship and went on a real planet. To me, that's not a good use of time or resources. I think Bethesda should leave this alone. We've seen over the past few years how many games have had great comebacks from getting bad reviews initially. No Man's Sky, Cyberpunk 2077, etc., etc. Now, that said, I don't think that Starfield is in that category. I actually think that it is a great game and could have been realistically nominated for Game of the Year were there more spots and were this not one of the best years of gaming ever. So I guess I think Bethesda should just be happy with what they've made and just let the reviews be what they are. We know people review bomb on Steam. So those are my thoughts. I guess one question I have for you, though, just about reviews in general, and I know that you're pretty meticulous, like, with what types of games you will buy and what types of games you will not buy. Do reviews ever play a role for you in, yeah, I'm going to buy this game, like, it has a 99% positive review? Or are you kind of like, nope, I know I'm going to like this regardless of what people are saying on the net?
Yeah, reviews do influence me on whether or not to get a game, 100%.
Wait, let's move on. This is coming from a source we don't usually pull from, but I thought this was a super interesting story and could possibly get us into a deeper discussion about capitalism in gaming versus the ability that money gives developers to continue to provide content long term. So voting with your wallet versus paying so that you can continue to play a game. Let's read the story. This is on tryhardguides.com, written by Shamia Ruina. Blizzard, the renowned game developer, is reportedly asking fans for their thoughts on the acceptability of a potential Diablo 4 add-on priced up to $100, as first reported by GameStar. The revelation surfaced through a video by Bellular News on YouTube, which detailed the leaked information shared by a fan. At this year's BlizzCon, the highly anticipated unveiling of Diablo 4's first expansion, titled Vessel of Hatred, took place. Set for late 2024 release, many details about the expansion, including its pricing, remain undisclosed. Earlier this week, Bellular News shared intriguing insights into Blizzard's potential pricing strategy for Diablo 4 add-ons. According to the YouTuber, a fan forwarded a confidential survey from the Diablo 4 developer, providing a glimpse into Blizzard's plans for add-on pricing. The leaked survey presented four pricing options: $50, $70, $80, and $100, each offering various benefits, including different amounts of platinum currency, which is in-game currency, for purchasing skins. So I guess this is concerning in Diablo 4 because people think it will provide people advantageous gameplay benefits. In other words, Mac, pay to win. But I'm curious, as gamers, do you think that we should feel the obligation to vote with our wallets when it comes to purchasing this type of content? Or should we know that if we love a game, we have to put more money in the pot for the developers to make the game sustainable long term? Would love to hear your thoughts on that, even though you don't play Diablo.
Well, I mean, I played Diablo 2. I enjoyed Diablo 2.
That's true.
Yeah. So, I mean, okay. I have an appreciation for the game world and for what's going on there. Right. So I don't know as I am the correct person to say what Diablo 4 should cost. Mr. Nice Guy, do you have figures at the moment as to what the price of Diablo 4 was upon launch? I assume $69.99.
Yeah, so here's the thing. And, you know, not to jump the gun, but Diablo 4 was just on sale on the Steam sale. And so the base version just recently was $41.99 before tax. Over the past week or so. But yeah, at launch, $69.99 for the base version. I believe there was a version that cost $10 more that was like a mid-tier. Mm-hmm. And then there was an ultimate edition that was $99.99 that gave you some perks and game perks and things like that.
Then the idea is that Vessel of Hatred gets, you know, 50. And I could not escape this news story. So unlike a lot of times when, you know, we're doing this show and you're getting me completely fresh, I did see this in the periphery.
Sure.
According to what I saw, the list was, they were like, hey, as part of the survey, you know, should it be $50? $75, $100, or like more. It was something like that, 50, 60, 80, whatever. I just know that it was in a range there.
Sure.
There was a time back in my day when DLCs or expansions were often included. Then of course there were times when expansions paid a little bit more, but often the expansions were less than the base game rather than more than the base game.
Sure.
Call me old fashioned, but I kind of feel that's the way it ought to be. And with respect to, do we as gamers need to come to grips with throwing in more money to support the things? I mean, Activision Blizzard is one of the biggest.
Fair.
If they are struggling to make the types of experiences that they want with the amount of money that they are charging for the games, maybe it's time for them to scale some of those plans back. I'm less inclined to think that they truly are providing such over and beyond that this extra money is requisite to make it happen, if that makes sense.
So great points. A couple things. I don't know what the survey said exactly. I would imagine that it was probably phrased in the form of how much would you be willing to pay for an expansion, mm-hmm. rather than should it cost 50, 60, 70, or 80. I could be wrong, but I feel like that's that latter option of should it cost this much, or this much is an obvious answer, right? People don't want to pay more than they have mm-hmm. to. Now, that said, you know, we compare it to how things used to be in the past. Games are objectively harder or more intensive now. You have voice actors, you have, you know, different graphics, you need more artists, you have writers who are writing the story, you have people who are composing the music. Not that you haven't had all of those things in the past, but I think that it's a much larger team and there's so much more scale that's required in game making today. So I understand that games cost more. Regardless of whether it's Activision or a small indie developer, people want to get paid, and I can't fault them for that. But the idea of charging $100 for an expansion to a game that costs $70 for the base copy at launch, I think is absurd. Mm-hmm. And I also want to point out that with Call of Duty, also made by Activision, they have gone the route of making their maps included. They no longer charge for map packs. They don't want to segment the community. And then they charge money in other ways to get funding. They have battle passes, which, by the way, Diablo has a battle pass. Mm-hmm. They have different skins you can purchase. So I think there's ways of getting your money without gouging the customers and the clients who are really, really into the game. Not that it should be free, but $100 is absurd.
Yeah.
Let's just call it what it is.
And on a $70 base game, I think even $50 is getting pretty darn close to the absurdity level. $20? Okay, I'll go with you on a journey there. $20 for an expansion on a $70 base.
Yeah, agree. Agree 100%. We got some great comments in the chat. Galvatron points out that video game seasons help sell DLC, keep player engagement steady, and allow developers to save money via delaying expensive sequels. That's a brilliant point. Another awesome point from our good friend Ishmobile. He says, back in my day, in quotes, DLC/expansions were some extra levels and possibly a couple of new mechanics. Maybe that DLC is more than that. I doubt it, though.
That is a good thing to bring up. It's like, do we know what would be coming in Vessel of Hatred?
I do not.
Yeah, I mean, this is the reporting's early. There's a lot of stuff we don't know. But, I mean, there does come a point in time where, is it a true, just a sequel? And if it is straight up a sequel, then yeah, charge it like a new game.
Yeah.
But, you know, then it's a sequel, not an expansion.
Yeah. Well, hey, there is another really awesome news story. We don't have time to do it today, but I want to point out to people, Jeff Keighley recently did a Q&A. He's with the Game Awards, as you know. He talked about the definition of an indie game. There's been some controversy about Dave the Diver, which has been nominated in the indie category, but comes from a large publisher with a lot of financial backing, et cetera, et cetera. And people feel that it should not be in the indie game category. We don't have time to get into that story today, but I'd love to hear from the chat what you think defines an indie game. Is it style? Is it the size of the team? Is it the amount of funding available? This is something that Mac and I discuss frequently as we're looking at Kickstarters. Who should have a Kickstarter? Who should not? Mac and I can't do it today as far as the conversation, but would love to hear from y'all. Tweet at us, email us, let us know. That has been news for the week.
All right. Well, now let's take a little look into the past for some video game history. This last week, Mr. Nice Guy, in years that came before, we saw some interesting things in video gaming happen. And I think I'll start at the most recent and sort of scale backward. So we'll start in 2002, where Squaresoft and Enix announce their merger. This was something that was going to be a little back and forth. Eventually, they would complete it. But this is when they announced that they were going to officially merge their companies. I have, and I think we've all sort of heard tell in the past about Final Fantasy Spirits Within forcing the merger between Squaresoft and Enix because Squaresoft lost so much money on that. Although they were already in talks to merge before the box office bomb that was Spirits Within. Neither here nor there. This is when we finally knew that such a thing was going to happen. And I don't know, while I do have a love and appreciation for Square titles before, I remember at that time being worried that Squaresoft was going to fundamentally change around the 2000s and being like, oh no, what's gonna happen? And I don't know if you would agree with me, Mr. Nice Guy, but I feel like the merger with Enix meant that Square Enix really did just kind of best case scenario. It just came back bigger and sort of better than before.
I would agree with that. You look at some of the stuff that they've come out with since then. I would agree with you 100%.
Doesn't always happen, but in this case, definitely did. Well, let's step back a few more years, Mr. Nice Guy, to 1998.
Good year.
This was the launch of the Game Boy Color. That would be in operation for, you know, well, the last Game Boy Color game would be released in 2002, so a not especially long way there, but it had such a, you know, such a dearth of video games already to available for it because you had the Game Boy standard games that could play on it. Mr. Nice Guy, I don't know if you had a favorite Game Boy Color title that was released for the Game Boy Color. Do you by chance?
I've got to go with two, and that's got to be Oracle of Ages and Oracle of Seasons. They are two of the most underappreciated Zelda games. And as someone who really loved Link's Awakening, it was great to play those games. In fact, I recently purchased, probably like 6 months ago, a physical copy of Oracle of Ages just because I want to have those forever. They're great games.
Mm-hmm. Fantastic games. Can't recommend them enough. I'm a little bit sad that we did not get the third of that series, because you remember, Mr. Nice Guy, there was supposed to be a third one, right?
I didn't know that, actually.
Oh, yeah. We'll talk about that again some other day. But yeah, there was absolutely going to be a third one that you would kind of port your games in from Oracles and Ages and port it forward.
Yeah.
But the Game Boy Color actually has one thing that's super cool that I've always been mystified by, and that is when you plug in a normal Game Boy game, it has some color to it that it just adds. But how does it know what to do? So when the Game Boy devices start up, as we know, they run a little bit, as do most Nintendo consoles, a little bit of a code at the beginning to check the system and to make copy protection checks. And when the Game Boy Color came out, they had this added, you know, utility, this added color palettes that they could use. And so they added a color palette option so that you could pick one out at the first screen that came up, that Nintendo screen, via game presses, something I had no idea about. And that was if the game that you were using didn't already have a selection. But they also included instructions that for 94 original Game Boy games that they went through, and they were like, okay, this color palette works best on game A, B, C, and so on and so forth. And it would specifically call up those palettes for it. But yeah, so they went through and they chose some, But then for others, you could just go ahead and select any of the palettes through button presses, which I had no idea about. And I feel a little bit sad that I didn't experiment with that or stumble across it back in those days, because I did plenty of playing of my classic games on the Game Boy Color. But hey, you learn something new every day.
Yeah.
Last thing, 1992, Sonic Tuesday. Nice guy. This is going out on a limb there, but does that ring any bells for you?
It doesn't, man. As much as I loved Sonic, I was really a Nintendo kid, so my experience with Sonic was quite a bit more limited, although I appreciate it. Tell me more.
So, Sonic Tuesday was a big launch event for Sega, and it was the release of Sonic 2 for not only the Sega Genesis, but also the Sega Game Gear. You know, of course, just for throwing it out there, Sega Game Gear had color in as far back as 92. Yep. Game Boy got it in 98. Neither here nor there. So one of the little hand-wavy things that I do as we're recording this show, Mr. Nice Guy, and doing research, is I tend to say, oh, a game was released this, you know, today or this week, back in year, whatever. But that's not always entirely accurate. It's especially not accurate back in the, like, arcade days, in the early 80s, when, like, I kid you not, most listings of when an arcade came out just lists the month. It usually doesn't list the day. And in the mid-80s, there's a lot of stuff where it's just, like, one outlet will claim, oh, it was published in June. Others will be like, oh, it wasn't published till October, or all that sort of nonsense. But one of the things that these things can be kind of both right at the same time is because before 1992, most games got released into different areas within the same country at the same time, or at different times. Like, cities on the coast would get them first, or the big cities, and then they'd eventually make their way inland. You know, in the Midwest, you might not get something till a week or two later. Having a single unified release date, something incredibly easy with digital, you know, distribution, was way harder when you were getting them to retail stores. And it wasn't common, really, until Sonic 2. They made a huge deal of it, making sure that units got to stores all across the United States and elsewhere, and so that it would be released on the 24th, on Tuesday, the 24th of that, and Sonic Tuesday. And it was also a huge deal because the Game Gear and the Genesis versions, but also they had a launch party including some very notable celebrities at the time.
Ooh, who?
How about Dustin Diamond?
Okay, Screech!
From Saved by the Bell, yeah. Yes.
Rest in peace.
How about Home Improvement's Jonathan Taylor Thomas and Zachary Ty Bryan?
Not a huge fan. I mean, they, like, it was a cool show. I liked the show.
He made
cool
a great show. Kid Simba is all I'm saying.
That's right.
And then they had a bunch of other, you know, celebrities, but those were just the ones that were most relevant to me. But they were almost all in their teens to kids, and they were there. Some of them acted as sort of pseudo spokesperson. It's the Sega of America actually, like, gave them basically a day before launch with Sonic 2 to play it and to learn how to play it. And then, so there's Dustin Diamond, there's Screech playing Sonic 2 for the, you know, for the press, and is, like, absolutely crushing it because he got direct coaching.
Nice.
On how to play and a day's worth of playtime before the media press event. So
that's awesome.
Yeah, just, like, wild some of the ways that stuff gets. But anyway, Sonic Tuesday, while it was not the first game that wound up releasing, it was certainly one of the first that had a release date that was standardized.
Yeah.
And, you know, you can owe that all to Sonic the Hedgehog 2 and Miles Tails Prowler. But Mr. Nice Guy, that is what I had for history this week.
Awesome. Well, super excited because now it's time for our Indie Game of the Week,
woo-hoo,
a segment where we talk about a game that may need more attention. And I'm going to post in the chat a link to this game on Steam. Mech, this week's game is called Bzz, spelled B-Z-Z-Z-T, three Zs.
Mm-hmm.
Here's the description on Steam. Jump into the retro future world with the nostalgic arcade journey of a tiny robot, ZX-8000. Experience an engaging story, upgrade your robotic abilities, challenge yourself in stages full of ever-changing gameplay mechanics, and compete with other players in global and friends leaderboards. Currently sits at 166 reviews on Steam. Very positive. Release date is November 13th, 2023. So this one just came out. Developer is KO.DLL, and publisher is Cinemax Games. Want to say thank you, as always, to the publisher and developer for sending us these codes for review. Will not affect our opinion. Mac, game is currently priced at $11.99. Would love to hear your thoughts on the game. Did you enjoy it? What did you like? What did you not?
I did enjoy it. It's a tight platformer. It is one of those where by normal difficulty, and you can turn it up and down a skosh, touching something does kill you and you have to start back at the beginning of the level. Now, when I was going through the game originally, my first playthrough, I did it on normal, and I felt very frustrated sometimes by the length of some of the levels with respect to how easy it was to die. I felt like I kind of changed my tune by the end. As I was going back through the game to play over earlier levels, beat them in order to get a trophy, I feel like they felt right, you know, as I was playing them back through. But in the time, in the moment, that first run through, I was just like, man, why can't there be a checkpoint in this level? This needs to be a checkpoint.
Did you feel like you were dying because of nonsense? Or did you feel like the game actually had fair deaths? That's my question. Because that's important for viewers to know.
When I was doing my first playthrough, I felt it was cheap. I felt it was nonsense. When I got through it and came back to other levels, I was just like, you know what? I think this really was just me not being precise enough. So I really do mean it. My tune on it completely changed after I got through it and started going back to replay the levels.
Okay.
It was just a case of get good. That's how I felt.
Okay.
Mr. Nice Guy, how about you?
So I really enjoyed this game. I think that, honestly, I disagree with you about there needing to be checkpoints for the levels. Because when you look at the projected finish time for each level, there's some that are 20 seconds, there's some that are like a minute. And there's a lot that are like 40 to 30 seconds.
Oh, yeah.
And so the idea of being able to go through a level in 30 seconds means that for 30 seconds or 40 seconds, you just have to be dialed in. And there's going to be a lot of trial and error, and it's going to be frustrating. But it's not like it's a five-minute level. It's not like Celeste, where you beat a couple screens and then there's a checkpoint because the level keeps going. It's like this is one quick level. You get it done and you keep going. I thought the controls were tight. I thought the upgrades were cool. And it made me think about how far we've come in gaming, because there's a lot of little details in terms of the art design that made this game look good. Little things in the background that are spinning, bright, vibrant colors, you know, little details that just made it cool. And I believe that the majority of this game, minus some things like the music, was made by one person. Obviously, the music and some other little things were helped, but he did a lot of this on his own. So to me, that made it even more fun. Mac, what did you think about the idea of leaderboards? Like, to you, is this a speedrunning game? Or is this like, oh, hey, I got 2 minutes. I can run through one of these levels. Or is this something that benefits from showing people how others are doing globally?
Well, it's nice to know that my scores are better than your scores.
Oh, stop it.
Obviously, it is a game that prioritizes quick movement and precision.
Yeah.
And because it has baked into it trophies for completing a game or a level perfectly, which inside of this game meant collecting all of the collectibles, the golden bolts, as well as getting to the exit within, you know, under a certain amount of time, and then it gave you points based on that. Because it has that sort of mini reward baked in, I think the addition of the leaderboard, not crazy, it seemed like a natural evolution of the game's base, you know, a base reward mechanics in the first place to add that on. Now, only one of my friends was on the leaderboard with me, and on the one side it shows you leaderboard totals across the whole game, and then it shows you, you know, your friends in a few slots as well. I liked being able to see how my friends were doing as opposed to, or friend, I've only got one.
That has the game.
Oh yeah, good distinction, Mr. Nice Guy. As opposed to the whole how everybody was doing. And I think, I don't know how they do it, but I have a suspicion that whoever's holding the top spot on that leaderboard, that there might be some shenanigans afoot.
I don't think there are, because I actually followed them on Twitter, the people who made this game, and they said that the person who is first on the leaderboards is the developer of some other game that I've heard of. And I can't remember what game it is right now. But it's someone who legitimately just played really well.
Oh.
I will say, to defend my score, there was one point where I was kicking your butt. Like,
oh, yeah.
I had so many more points than you, and I was like, I'm done. I'm putting the game down. And then Mac came back and was like, I'm not done. I'm not putting the game down. And, like, passed my score up. So I think that adds, like, another level of replayability, which I almost feel like in some ways it's artificial replayability, because at some point people are going to have to ask themselves, like, is this legitimately fun to keep adding to my score, or is it just my competitive nature that's making me want to keep playing this game? Now, that said, the game is super fun, and I personally could recommend this game. I think it's absolutely worth $11.99, and the thing that I like about it is it's tight controls. The story is whatever. Like, you're a robot, there's some bad people, blah, blah, blah. It was challenging enough that I was having a good time without wanting to pull out my hair, right? Mm-hmm. And it has a lot of charm. You know, it's a nice indie game, especially if you have a Steam Deck. You know, you could pick this up and play for 5 or 10 minutes and put it down without having to feel like you're missing out on something. So I liked that.
Yeah.
Mac, what are your final thoughts on this game? Price point, good. Would you recommend this? What else do you think?
Recommend it. Price point, fantastic for 11 bucks. And yeah, it didn't even get installed on my desktop because, you know, why would I? It's perfect for my Steam Deck. And yeah, I went through, I played the story mode, got to the end, thought it was great, and then, you know, went back and grabbed those trophies, a couple of hours to beat it, and then the rest of it to perfect it.
Yeah.
And it is doable. If Mac can pull it off, anybody can. But that nightmare mode, 7 deaths to complete the entire all the levels on, that's a trophy I'm not getting. That's an achievement that's not coming my way.
Yeah, forget that. Yeah. Yeah, I will say one last thing is you get upgrades as you go throughout the game, and it's kind of cool. Once you've played through and you have all those upgrades, you can go back and some of them help you do the previous levels faster.
Oh, yeah.
Right. So you can upgrade. You have double jump. You can sprint. Like, it makes it so you get more replayability and improve your score just by having played through the game.
Yes,
so
indeed.
I recommend this. Shout out to the developer for hooking us up.
If I have just one last thing, I would love it if there was checkpoints to refill your lives after the mini bosses in the nightmare mode, but hey, you know, that's just because I need to get good. Anyway, thanks so much. I loved it. Much appreciated for Bzzzt.
Indie game of the week. Thank you so much.
Well, now we turn to a crowdfunding project that's trying to get off the ground. We call this Kick or Kickstart. I'll post a link in the chat. Mr. Nice Guy will be seeing this for the first time, and we will talk about the virtues, the vices, and whether it should be kickstarted or kicked out of here. And yes, I wish nightmare mode wasn't so nightmarish. Yeah, that is me. All right, so what is this? This is for a physical book. It's called Game Book Color. Now, you may have seen a previous game book that was done earlier this year for, or was it later last year? Anyway, that was done not that long ago on Kickstarter as a compilation, a companion, unofficial as it was, for the original Game Boy. That went out reasonably well reviewed, looked good. And now he's back to focus on the gamebook color. And it did, of course, fit very thematically for what we were talking for video game history. It has already met its $25,000 goal in order to produce the printed hardcover books that are going out. So it's still got 15 days to go. Now, if you're looking to get these, yeah, it's a $38 minimum to get that hardcover book. And then plus however much it'll be for shipping. This is a project coming out of the UK, so you're looking at probably at least $10 to $15 shipping. And then it'll be shipping somewhere in the neighborhood of March of 2024. This project has three tiers. Three reward tiers. The most interesting are the base tier, $38 minimum, and the second tier, which is $64, 50 euros, that's why, you know, but $64. And sure. That one includes a few extras, like, you know, a bookmark and whatever, but that tier includes a digital copy of the book. But the base tier doesn't. And there's no option on this for the digital-only tier. And as long as I understand, I went through the rewards process, or looking at the rewards, unless there is an add-on reward that is available but isn't listed in the thing, and you have to go through the actual purchase, the actual backing thing, it doesn't appear as though there is a way for you to get your hands on, you know, just straight the digital copy. Because I would make a pledge for just, you know, the $1 thing and then try to get an add-on for the digital copy. I'd love to have a digital one of these, but I don't know as I want to go through the trouble of the added cost, $38 plus another $10 to $15 for the shipped book. But I'd certainly love to have the digital for my reader. So, I don't know. Mr. Nice Guy, any thoughts?
Yeah, so the thing that I really, really like about this, and for those who may not remember, earlier this year, Mac actually reached out to, or someone reached out to Mac, I can't remember, about a video game book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I feel terrible. I can't remember the name right now. But it was really, really good. And mm-hmm. It was a gaming history book much like this. And I think that these things are great to have because I read through them and I learned some things I didn't know. Is that information on the internet? Yes, it is, but it's still a great conversation piece that I can have on my coffee table, on my shelf, and I can go back and read it from time to time. So I like the idea of this. The other thing I like is that, you know, I like retro game shopping, and one of the easiest consoles to collect for is the Game Boy. They don't take up a lot of space. A lot of the games are reasonably priced,
mm-hmm.
and there's a lot of hidden gems that I just didn't know about growing up that I've discovered through thrifting and game hunting. So having a book like this would probably turn me on to even more games that I didn't know about that I could find a way to play. The thing that I don't like about this is the price. I mean, just to be candid, you know,
mm-hmm.
There are used bookstores all over the place. We've probably all heard of half-price books. If you're a book person, you can find books very, very cheaply. And so $38 for a hardcover book that is this niche, I think, is a lot. And the last thing I'll say about this, Mac, is one of the biggest challenges with Kickstarters is the intelligence level of the consumer. Because as an intelligent consumer, I can look at this and I can say $25,000, they've reached their goal. In an ideal world, they're going to make this book. There's no reason for me to purchase it now because I can wait until it's on Amazon or until it's available after the fact, and I can wait until it's at a discount. Before you reach that $25,000 pledge amount, you really feel like you're helping make the thing get made.
Mm-hmm.
But once it's already reached its amount, you're not really doing that anymore. And so if you're a baller on a budget, hashtag baller on a budget, you think, well, I'm just going to wait until there's a Steam sale, if it's a video game, or until this book is available at a cheaper price. And so I think that they may not see their amount go up much more. And that's unfortunate, but...
Yeah. Well, I'm glad that it's going to be produced. I hope that it is as successful as the previous one. Seems like it's probably going to be more. One thing that is definitely really cool as an add-on is they have these little enamel pins of the Game Boy Color in all the colors that it was available for. And that's definitely a cute little thing that I'm like, man, I kind of just want to get my hands on those enamel pins. We desperately need things like this that show video games as art, not just right now, but also throughout time. I think it's a thing that needs to be seen. I'm glad it's getting produced, but I feel similarly. I think at this point I'll probably wait for later. I would definitely be all about this if there was an option for the digital. For the digital copy, because I'd love to have a copy, but I'm not going to, back at the $64 level just to get the digital copy that I want, and also bring a hardcover along as well. But, you know, different strokes for different folks, and it certainly has been popular with some, so, you know, more power to them, but a kick for me, just because I think we should be able to get the digital copy all by its lonesome.
Yeah, I agree, and I've never seen one where the tiers are designed like this, but to each their own. I would say Kickstart as well. I think that this is almost as important a part of maintaining video game history as ROMs. The stories behind the games are so, so important. We think about Kirby and how that was part of Nintendo lawsuit, right? The name of the lawyer. And I mean, there's just different tidbits about gaming history that we get from these books that are great. So I say Kickstart.
Well, as always, we wish them all luck, but that has been Kick or Kickstart.
Awesome. And now it is time for Nerdflex.
Woohoo!
A segment where you, the viewers, try to stump the hosts, and sometimes you do, sometimes you don't. For those who are here live, you know that you have a job to do. If you'd like to, put a multiple choice gaming-related question in the chat. Mac and I will use nothing but our noggins to try to answer it. If you're feeling shy today, never fear. We have a test bank of randomized questions that we will go to. And so that's where we're going to start today, Mac, is with that test bank. Question number one. It's a Nintendo question. Which Nintendo character was originally called Tinkle Popo? That's spelled Tinkle and then P-O-P-O, two separate words. I am not sure, but I could make an educated guess.
My educated guess would be Tingle from the Legend of Zelda franchise, but that's all I can think of.
Interesting.
What was your educated guess?
It's funny because I was talking about Kirby earlier, and for whatever reason, I would go with Kirby. I'm sure that's not the right answer.
Well, it's...
But it just seems like it's kind of a cutesy name. Kirby's a cutesy character. It seems like that could be Kirby.
Yeah, well, I say we both go with our respective answers and see how both of us are wrong.
Since it's not multiple choice, we can split our decision, and let's flip this card and see what it is. Oh my gosh! It was Kirby!
It was Kirby?
Yeah, people are going to think that we cheat. That's wild. Of all the Nintendo characters... One in a million. We got that right.
That is in Crayob, Mr. Nice Guy. But if anybody was going to nail such a thing, I mean, you know so much about video games.
Maybe I read about that somewhere and just forgot. But That's wild. I gotta look that up.
That's fantastic.
I think we have a question in the chat, right?
We do. The Ishmobile crew has a question for us. What is the name of the song GLaDOS sings in the credits of Portal? Is it A, this credit song, B, still alive, C, want you gone, and D, are you still here?
This one's easy. Mac, what do you think?
So I know, I will say C, want you gone, is the title of the song from Portal 2. B, still alive is definitely
B. Yep.
B, final answer.
And we know that's right. Now, fun fact, when Mac and I went to E3, we tried out a Portal game that was on, I believe it was the PlayStation, using PlayStation Move controllers. This will be some interesting... Mac, tell them about that game, because I don't think it ever came out, but it was awesome.
Yeah, I think you're right. I don't think it came out, but it was Portal, but with the added thing that you could use the movement control, the move controllers to resize objects in space. So like they provided you with like a block and we stretched it out to make like a ramp that we could go up. I think we also like resized a thing and like moved objects around in three-dimensional space, rotated them, flipped them over, and put them in as like keys. It was a lot more puzzles when you could sort of move things around like that. But yeah, I don't think I ever saw it aside from there at E3 when we visited.
It's crazy how many awesome games just don't see the light of day.
Yeah.
But anyway, moving on. We got another question from Galvatron Type R. Which Castlevania game did Koji Igarashi first take head producer duties? Simon's Quest, Super Castlevania 4, Rondo of Blood, Symphony of the Night, Chronicles, Circle of the Moon, or Lords of Shadow? He gives us so many choices there.
Mm-hmm.
So, Mac, I'm just going to assume that it's probably one of the later Castlevanias. Mm-hmm. So I would cross off Simon's Quest and maybe Super Castlevania 4. Mm-hmm. But I don't know beyond that which one it would have been.
I mean, Symphony of the Night was certainly, I feel like, a great one. Also a departure. It's really interesting because I kind of want to say Lords of Shadow just because I know absolutely nothing about it.
That was my instinct.
Yeah. You know, let's go with that instinct. I don't know anything, so this is just a shot in the dark. But let's go for it anyway. Because if I was thinking that and you were thinking that.
Yeah, why not? Now, we usually don't take extra questions, but we do have a fourth one in the chat today. What do you think, Mac? Do we have time for a fourth question, or are we running tight?
We are running tight, and I already know I've got a big legalese.
We'll have to skip that. Please send that next week.
We got it wrong.
What was the answer?
Chronicles. Chronicles was the correct answer. So shame on us. Although 2 out of 3, as my boy Meatloaf would say, that's not bad.
That ain't bad. Hey, that has been legal. Or excuse me, that has been Nerdflex.
Well, now we turn to a little bit of legalese.
Legalese.
I'm not a lawyer. I just play one here on a podcast. And you may very well have seen some news recently about a class action complaint against Take-Two for NBA 2K franchise's microtransactions. So, Mr. Nice Guy.
Yes.
As well as everybody. Before we even get into the details of this specific complaint, at the end of the complaint, of any complaint, there is always something called a prayer for relief. And that is where you ask the court for what you want them to do.
Okay.
Now, this is usually a really good way to spot a difference between a serious lawsuit and performance art, which unfortunately has been happening a lot more frequently. A lot of people filing lawsuits as basically performance art.
Sure.
So always go skip to the end of a complaint and see what it is that they're asking a court to do. If they ask for something reasonable, like money or to you to stop doing something, sounds like a reasonable thing a court could do, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
But if, for example, you ask for custody of your children to be determined via trial by combat with katanas, that seems unreasonable, right?
Definitely unreasonable, unless it's like a Japanese game show.
Nope. 2020 David Ostrom in Iowa court. So, I mean, you know, that's performance art.
Yeah.
The other things read. So let's go ahead and what did these people ask for in this lawsuit against NBA 2K? Well, against Take-Two. They want for the court to certify this as a class action and to order Take-Two to stop getting rid of virtual currency from accounts and to pay damages from the lost virtual currency that people have had, and then the usual catch-all phrase of restitution fees and other such relief as this court may deem just and proper. So the complaint alleges at the heart of this that every year 2K puts out a new sports game and they retire the old sports game and disconnect the servers, and the virtual currency that you had in there goes poof.
Yeah, that's true.
They contend that that going poof is conversion, it's civil theft, and it's unfair business practices, and they should stop it. So that's the heart of the complaint. There's some more details in there and everything like that going on, but that's really what it's getting at. This lawsuit is going to run into a host of issues for several reasons. So this is not going anywhere, Mr. Nice Guy.
Sure, sure.
For a few reasons. Number one, the end user license agreements on all these things contain binding individual arbitration in the EULA.
Of course!
Of course. That's the first thing that, and depending upon the jurisdiction, that'll be a full stop. Number two, the venue. They are suing in, they're suing in California. The EULA specifically cites New York will be the venue. And if you're wondering, Mac, did you read the Take Two EULA in preparation for tonight? You're gosh darn right I did. But even if it did survive both jurisdictional as well as arbitration, perhaps the biggest issue is that in the EULA, right, we have this wording that says, we've heard it all before, things are licensed to you. You are not buying them. And that extends to virtual goods as well as, surprise, surprise, virtual currency. Quote, licensor, Take Two, has the absolute right to manage, regulate, control, modify, suspend, and or eliminate such virtual currency and or virtual goods as it sees fit in its sole direction and shall have no liability to you or anyone else for the exercise of those rights. And so because no jurisdiction has held otherwise that a virtual currency or virtual goods in this sense really constitutes a property right, but rather these are all governed by licensing, temporary, revocable, non-transferable, you would essentially, this would be like the first court to determine such a thing. So to be absolutely clear, I think it's BS what we've done with digital ownership, but this is not the case that's going to carry water. I'll update you all when this case gets bounced for any number of the procedural reasons. It's a shame that it's going to be bounced for procedural reasons because I think there's reasonable discussions to be had about digital ownership of items, both video games, virtual currency, and virtual goods. But this is not at all the case that's going to carry that discussion forward, much as we need to have, desperately, a legal discussion about that. Anyway, that's not the law, that's just legalese.
Yeah, can I just say, as someone who played NBA 2K for many, many years and isn't opposed to at some point getting back in, the idea that you could spend, you know, a couple hundred dollars on leveling up your My Player to get him to level 99, play with him for a year in the park, and then he's just gone, and then the next year you have to do the exact same thing, it's not unethical, but it's pretty dang close. And the same thing with the My Team. You put all this time and energy into grinding, and a lot of people use that pay-to-win philosophy. They buy the VC. It's not required. But, I mean, it is a lot of money that people are losing every year to be able to play this game. And it's part of gaming. We talked about it earlier with Diablo. You know, vote with your wallet. But there's got to be a better way than the annual release. Especially, and I want to end on this, Mac, just because the My Player is not even tied to the NBA roster. They should make it so that your My Player can carry over from year to year to year. My Team, I get it. There's roster changes, et cetera, et cetera. But the My Player is it's silly that goes away.
And with that, that's been Legalese. Agreed 100%, Mr. Nice Guy. Now that's the show, but before we go, Nice Guy, we've got to talk about these games and these shows that we are into. What have you been into, my dude?
Dude, I've been into so much, and I want to hear what people in the chat are into, too. Because we're looking for that nerdy stuff to get into. So, Mac, I never did finish Atlanta. For those of you who are not familiar, it's a show by Donald Glover. It's a comedy, but it also has like a lot of social commentary in a sitcom format. Not in a sitcom format, in a comedy format. It's not a sitcom. But I really, really enjoy it. I'm on season 3. And been laughing hysterically, but also been contemplating the world and the different messages he puts out. It's a dope show if you like that type of thing. And then also been playing a lot of Diablo 4. Now, the Steam sale just ended. Diablo 4 was available for free to play this past weekend, this past week, actually. And you could play up to level 20. And then once you got to level 20, you could, you know, keep playing and not level, or you could buy the game. And I bought the game, and I am absolutely in love with Diablo 4. Surprised that it's not on the Game of the Year list for the Game Awards, but it is what it is. For the sake of time, Mac, those are my top things right now. Oh, and I got to say Sea of Stars as well. Sea of Stars is phenomenal. Mac, what have you been watching and playing?
So for playing as frequently as I can manage it, 5th edition D&D. Also, GURPS, my main
game.
Also, I've been playing some Bzzzt, naturally, and Dark Souls. Prepare to Die edition. I've been getting back into Dark Souls. I never finished it. I put something like, I don't know, maybe 6 hours into it. I died an awful lot. And now I'm thinking I'm gonna try and finish it. It's something that I need to, you know, plant that flag at the top of the mountain and call it good. So yeah.
Nice.
As for watching, I've mostly been watching past seasons of Taskmaster, as we finished off the most recent season that aired over the weekend. And gosh, that's kind of about it. Fun British panel show. So yeah, that's what I've been into lately.
Nice. I forgot to mention Leverage and also the new Hunger Games movie. I'm not sure if I mentioned that last
You mentioned
week,
that you were gonna go watch it, and I think you said that you enjoyed it.
I thought it was phenomenal. Everybody, thank you so much for tuning in. We appreciate you hanging out. We're coming up on the end of the year, which means that soon enough we'll be doing our Game of the Year episode. We'll have a special guest. If you've been here in the past, you know who it is. But we'll announce that soon enough. And also, Mac and I have been bouncing around the idea of doing an indie game of the year because we played a ton of indies this year. And thank you to those developers. So more news on that to come. Thank you for tuning in. We appreciate y'all. Please like, subscribe, share, leave reviews. It helps us with the algorithms. And most importantly, be excellent to each other. We'll see y'all soon. Deuces.
Bye.